From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, we meet the director of the first film to receive the NC-17 rating. Philip Kaufman's new movie, Henry and June, is about the relationships between writers Anais Nin, Henry Miller, and his wife June. Also today, we talk with Indian poet Vikram Seth about writing in rhyme. Classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz remembers conductor and composer Leonard Bernstein. And TV critic David Bianculli reviews Nixon, the latest installment of the public TV series The American Experience. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Iraq sounded a defiant tone again today, rejecting any notion of compromise advanced by the Soviet Union over the weekend and turning out thousands of people for a military demonstration. NPR's Jackie Lydon reports.
The People's Army, a civilian militia, held a graduation parade today for some 11,000 volunteers who ranged in age from teenagers to the elderly. 500 of the group were women. All carried bazookas, sniper rifles, or bayonets, and there were detachments of just under 1,000 Egyptians, Syrians, Sudanese, and even Kurds, the ethnic people gassed by Iraq in the last war. One commander claimed that Iraq could call on 8 million such volunteers if it came to war, but some Iraqi civilians told non-Western reporters today that they were more hopeful for peace than eager for bloodshed. I'm Jackie Lydon in Baghdad.
President Bush today compared stories of alleged Iraqi atrocities in Kuwait with those of Hitler in World War II, and he warned that war crimes could lead to trials like those held at Nuremberg. The president described the Iraqi acts as Hitler revisited. He was referring to recent testimony from Kuwaiti refugees that Kuwaitis are being tortured and killed by Iraqi troops for alleged resistance activities. Very delicately, the Bush administration is criticizing Israel for rejecting UN investigators who want to look into the slayings of 21 Palestinians on the hallowed Temple Mount. But U.S. officials stress that despite the flap, relations with Israel are good. Barry Schweid reports.
President Bush took a few seconds out from campaigning for Republicans to say that admitting the investigators would have been the right thing to do. State Department spokeswoman Margaret Tutwiler said the U.S. is disappointed with the cabinet's rejection of the U.N. mission, saying it would have given Israel a chance to give its version of the incident. According to the Israeli media, Secretary of State James Baker urged Foreign Minister David Levy before the cabinet vote to let the U.N. in. Otherwise, Baker warned, world attention would be focused on Israel instead of Iraq. Even so, spokeswoman Tutwiler said U.S. relations with Israel are good, despite disagreements over various issues. For National Public Radio, this is Barry Schweid at the State Department.
French President François Mitterrand said today that his country will stand by its offer of asylum for former Lebanese Christian strongman Michel Aoun. General Aoun took refuge in the French embassy in Beirut on Saturday after his headquarters was captured by Syrian and Lebanese government forces. The Lebanese government has demanded that Aoun be handed over until it can determine whether or not to try him for theft and war crimes. Stock prices were moderately higher today on Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 18 points to close at 2,416.34 on volume of 166 million shares. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Philip Kaufman, directed the new movie Henry and June. It's the first film to receive the rating NC-17, which stands for No Children Under 17 Admitted. NC-17 is the alternative to the X rating. The X had recently come under fire for effectively censoring serious movies with adult themes by equating those movies with pornography. Many theaters had a policy against showing X-rated films. Ironically, the first movie to have the new rating is in part about the writer Henry Miller, whose novel The Tropic of Cancer was censored for close to three decades in America until a 1964 Supreme Court decision. Henry and June is based on the diaries of Anais Nin. Her diaries were first published in 1966, and her independent thinking made this work inspirational in the feminist movement. But the movie is based on a part of her diaries that she suppressed until the deaths of the involved parties. It's the story of her brief romantic relationship with Henry Miller, who became her lifelong friend, and his wife June. The movie is set in Paris in 1931, the year Nin met Henry and June. I asked Philip Kaufman if he was pleased to have the distinction of making the first film to be rated NC-17.
Well, I'm very pleased that our film can be shown complete, and this was the only way, or probably the only way that could have been done. We were given an X rating, which meant that for a long period we weren't allowed to even have trailers or any advertising. We were about to appeal to try to get an R rating, but for that you have to get a two-thirds majority of the appeals board, and that can be a pretty sensitive thing, pretty difficult thing to do. So I'm glad that the film is out there, and I'm glad that by not cutting the film we were able to force a change in the system.
Well, this film has really set a precedent, and it's the first example we have of how theaters and newspaper advertising departments are treating films with this new rating. So what have you seen so far? Are most theaters who'd show this kind of film, by this kind of film I mean a more arty kind of film, you know, and it's not an action film. So right. Are most theaters who would show this kind of film showing it, and are newspaper advertising departments accepting ads for the movie?
Right. By and large, that's true. You know, the first week it was in, originally booked in 77 theaters around the country. That was cut down to 76 because in one town, Dedham, Massachusetts, some people, some selectmen decided that the theater should not be allowed to show the film, even though they hadn't seen the film at that point. And I think one place in the South, Birmingham, I think one of the newspapers doesn't want to run ads or even mention the film as being there, although I understand that in that area the theater chain is fighting that.
Were you concerned about getting an X when you were making the film, and did that enter into what you decided to show and how you decided to show it?
I was making an R-rated movie, I felt. My last film was The Unbearable Lightness of Being, and I really felt that I was working within the same guidelines as we had done that film with. I was sort of surprised. It just seemed that we knew we were pushing, you know, aiming for the line, so to speak, but we didn't feel that there was anything in this film that should push it into the X category. In fact, Unbearable Lightness of Being had some more, you know, nudity and so forth, things that were traditionally might have put it into the X category. But I was surprised. Tom Pollock, who is the head of Universal Studios, read the script and thought it would be an R-rated movie. And he saw the film and thought it was an R-rated film, as did I and as did the people who were working on it. Something happened along the way. I suppose their standards tightened, or new people came to the board, or perhaps because the film concerns a woman's search for her sexual identity as opposed to a man's, that put certain people on edge.
Let me make another suggestion. There are a couple of lesbian scenes in it. That might have had something to do with it.
Well, that's true. That might have, although Unbearable Lightness of Being certainly had a sort of extended scene between two women. You know, whether it's called lesbian or whatever, the mystery that is being explored between the two women is all about there. Certainly the scene in Unbearable Lightness of Being was, you know, had female frontal nudity and so forth, and in some ways, you know, went a little bit beyond some of the scenes in this film.
You said that you tried to keep to the same guidelines with Henry and June that you kept with,
right,
with The Unbearable Lightness of Being. What were the guidelines that you were keeping in mind?
Well, I just thought that, you know, since that film had been an R-rated film, that, you know, there were scenes of nudity, there were scenes of, you know, sexual exploration within the boundaries of a film that was a serious film. Certainly a film with serious content, serious intent, really. And I felt that that would distinguish it from what I would have expected to be an X-rated film, and not only Unbearable Lightness of Being, but, you know, so many other films that had been given an R, even after they were cut, seemed to go a step beyond beyond this film. You know, in some ways, Wild at Heart or Wild Orchid, after it was cut, put into theaters. I just felt that, and again, so did the head of Universal, felt that they were making a bad mistake by doing this.
Did Universal ever ask you to re-edit your movie?
No, they never did.
The previous X controversies of the past few months had to do with independent films like Tie Me Up, Tie Me Down, The Cook, The Thief, Henry, Portrait of a Serial Killer. Wild at Heart had briefly gotten an X, and then they re-edited it. And a lot of people just assumed, since now it was a major, it was Universal who had been given the X, that it was more likely that there was going to be movement with the MPAA. And in fact, it was after your film, you know, distributed by Universal, got the X, that the MPAA changed. Do you know what Universal did behind the scenes?
I don't know, you know, the full story on that, but I do know that, you know, there was a lot of pressure prior to all of this, of course, and all of those things, including the judge's statements in the Tie Me Up, Tie Me Down case, you know, had to be motivating, you know, the MPAA and Jack Valenti to take another look at all of this. What happened exactly, I don't know, and I was very pleased that it did happen, though, just prior to us going to the appeal. I just think, you know, everything added up to it was a time for change, and I thought it spoke very well for the MPA to try to address all of the problems, both of the creative rights of the filmmakers, the, quote, artistic integrity, and to try to redefine for parents a system of guidelines that would make them better informed. They copyrighted the NC-17 category as opposed to the X, which was not copyrighted. And the R category will now talk about whether it's sex or violence or language, which I think is an improvement, because I know a lot of parents who would like to know about those things, who object particularly to violence.
Philip Kaufman is my guest, and he directed the new film Henry in June. Henry in June, I mean, this is a movie about Anaïs Nin, who, among other things, wrote erotica, and Henry Miller, who is most famous for Tropic of Cancer, which was banned in this country for around 30 years. So, I mean, these are two people who wrote about sex and wrote passionately and vividly about it, and wanted, I mean, Anaïs Nin wrote erotica so her readers would get aroused, you know. So what were your considerations in putting sexual scenes on the screen in terms of how explicit to get and how arousing you wanted it to be?
Well, we were trying to be faithful to the material, which was the unexpurgated journal of Anaïs, called Henry in June, that we discovered 4 years ago when it was published. It was quite a surprise to my wife and myself when we read the material. We had read a lot, you know, we had met Henry Miller, we had met Anaïs Nin, we had read, I guess, virtually everything that they had written. But in the earlier journals of Anaïs Nin, we were given a much more objective viewer in her own journals. And then suddenly this sexual person was revealed. Again, this is not the Henry Miller of Tropic of Cancer. This is the Henry Miller as revealed in the journals of Anaïs Nin. And I think it's important to keep that clear, too, that, you know, we're making a film that, you know, sexuality is one of the subjects of the film, but it's also an exploration of a lot of other things, of innocence, of maintaining innocence as we go through life, experiencing things, of a literary relationship. I mean, the other thing that was so amazing about the relationship of Henry and Anaïs was that it was a lifelong relationship. That that did have this erotic beginning to it, this very highly sexually charged beginning, but lasted a lifetime. And literary relationships being what they are, this was an extraordinary relationship and friendship.
I'm curious whether you wanted the love scenes to be sexually arousing to your viewers. And I ask this in the context that for some people in the courts, that might seem like a bad thing. It might make it seem prurient. On the other hand, some viewers have complained that they didn't find it arousing enough and that they thought they should have been more aroused by the scenes. So I was wondering what you wanted your viewers to experience.
Well, you know, that response, some people, because they heard it got an X rating, you know, wanted to see something, you know, that went way beyond the intention.
Well, I'm even thinking of some film critics here, though.
Yes, but that's what I'm talking about.
Okay.
Exactly. Because I've read a couple of those reviews, but the basic thing behind all of that, of course, is, you know, what different people find sexy is something you can't calculate. Some, you know, I find that the film is sexy and was meant to be that way. It's about sexuality. But for, you know, some people require things that go, you know, much more further afield to be aroused. And I, you know, sometimes find even in a look or a gesture a lot of sexuality. So it really depends on the viewer, and it also depends to some extent on the set they go in to see the film with. Expecting the ultimate sexual movie, that wasn't our original intention. We, as I say, we're trying to explore within the context of the journal of Anais Nin these relationships. And the film is also a lot of these viewers, because it's about sexuality and because it had gotten an X rating, view the film almost in total silence, as if they were going to church in a way, you know, breathing hard, waiting for, you know, to be blown away by these things. And the film is meant to have a lot of fun in it, and from the very beginning, a kind of pervading humor that is, if missed, the film then is viewed in a totally different way. And that's an unfortunate viewing.
Let's take a short break and then we'll talk some more. And my guest is Philip Kaufman. His new movie is Henry in June. This is Fresh Air. Film director Philip Kaufman is my guest, and his movies include the new movie Henry in June, The Unbearable Lightness of Being, The Right Stuff, the remake of The Invasion of the Body Snatchers, and The Wanderers. Henry in June is about the relationship between the writer Anais Nin, the writer Henry Miller, and his wife June, and it's based on Nin's diary from the year 1931, the year that she met Miller. So you and your wife, who co-wrote the screenplay, read this very carefully, and I'm sure you went back and reread a lot of Miller and Nin's stuff. I know that you probably talked about the relationship between Miller, Nin, and June for a long time. What were the things that you were most interested in, that you found either most baffling or most of interest to you?
Well, the first thing, or one of the first things that jumped out to us was the character of June, who... It became clear had not only inspired thousands of pages in Henry Miller's writings. I mean, most of his major work in terms of the novels was preoccupied with his obsession with his wife June, particularly Sexus, Plexus, Nexus, Tropic of Capricorn, and even in Tropic of Cancer. June is... His not only his muse, but his fixation and the thing that obsesses him. Anais's novels, too, deal to a great extent with this character, June, and her relationship with June. So here was a kind of mysterious figure in literature to whom thousands of pages had been devoted, who was virtually unknown except through the journals of Anais. So... That and Anais, on meeting June, thought she was the most beautiful woman she'd ever seen. So that was an interesting thing to us. And then it was, of course, really the passion that had existed between Henry and Anais, and the way that Henry sort of, in a way, began to open Anais up from, if you read the earlier journals, there was, you know, a woman who was in a kind of a stable or almost stable relationship, married to a man she loved very much. With the meeting with Henry, her life begins to change considerably, and she goes through, you know, the most passionate, wildest period of her life, really.
What effect did Henry Miller's writing have on you when you first read him, and when and how did you first read him?
Well, I read him when I was in college.
When the book was still banned in the States.
It was banned, sure. Well, except there were things that you could read, you know, some things that had been allowed in that weren't censored. And certainly around that time I read Colossus of Marussi, which I think is a wonderful book that led us in great part to go live in Greece for a while back in the very early 60s, the beginning of the 60s. But Miller, there was just something about his spirit of, you know, burning his bridges behind him, of living the creative life, of really, Miller was writing about self-liberation, and there was a contagious quality to that writing that really appealed to me, you know, that we within ourselves had to become our own saviors and not keep looking for saviors from without. And I think that was, you know, one of the dominant themes of his writing. And there was a great generosity on his part toward other writers, and that, you know, exemplified itself in the way he used to talk about Anais Nin, you know, way before we knew there was anything between them. He always liked her, you know, kind of promoted her writings. She was then very, you know, unknown, but particularly her journals, which he said when they're published, they're going to be some of the important journals of the century, he felt. And so I met Miller. Rose and I met Miller. My wife and I went to visit him in Big Sur in 1960, and spent a day and on into the night with him. And there was quite a different man from, you know, the Tropic of Cancer, the kind of angry Miller. He was an extremely gentle man by all accounts of all people who'd met him. There was this gentle man, and this was interesting in the way that Anais really talks about Henry, so that you get that man more in our film than you would get out of the writings of Henry Miller.
Mm-hmm. How did you first read Tropic of Cancer?
Well, it was like, you know, these were all smuggled copies. You know, it was, I'm sure it had been well thumbed, pages stuck together, all of those kinds of things. And somebody passed it on to me. And then, you know, in later years, when I would go to Europe and hitchhike around Europe, you could buy his books there and smuggle them back in, you know, in the dirty, hidden way at the bottom of your bag and, you know, in the dirty laundry. I mean, everybody was looking for Henry Miller books at that time. When you came into the country, that was the thing they seemed to be most eager to intercept.
Film director Philip Kaufman is my guest. His new movie is Henry and June. Several of your movies have been based on books. Henry and June is based on Nin's diaries and The Unbearable Lightness of Being on the Kundera book. What was it like with The Unbearable Lightness of Being to have Kundera still alive and able to consult with you on the adaptation? And I was wondering if his presence gave you the liberty to do things that you might otherwise would have felt was cheating.
Well, he didn't come to the set. We really worked on this.
You didn't send him the screenplay or anything?
Oh yeah, sure. I co-wrote the screenplay with Jean-Claude Carrière, mm-hmm. a wonderful French screenwriter, novelist, and so forth. But I did spend, you know, weeks with Kundera. Kundera and I'd go to his apartment in Paris every morning, and we would go through all the details of the script. And he had been a professor of, you know, he taught film in Prague when he was living there, screenwriting, actually. And so, I mean, his first word to us was eliminate. He, in fact, after he saw the film, you know, he said, people will ask you why you don't have the whole book in there. He said, but you tell them that that he timed his book out, and it would have run 26 hours if it had been filmed as it was. But no, he knew and agreed, I think, with the idea of eliminating, in a way, the most interesting character in the book, which that is to say, Kundera, the narrator, you know, the one with whose mind jumps around and explores all the characters. In order to bring things out of the book and put them on the screen, we had to, you know, find a way of doing that. And in a way, we felt that the narrator was in some way substituted for by the mood of the Janacek music that we put in, really. And it was really Kundera who sort of introduced me to Janacek. We'd sit in his apartment listening to Janacek and really decided that the smaller Janacek pieces, quartets or piano, you know, the smaller things would be appropriate for this film.
I know you had some trouble on early projects that you worked on. You were writing, I think, writing of a movie version of Star Trek, and the studio didn't want to bring it out until Star Wars was a big hit. And then you worked on The Outlaw Josie Wales with Clint Eastwood, but ended up leaving or being fired from, I'm not sure which, the movie. What went wrong on that?
On
Josie Wales.
Well, Josie Wales, we just had a... whatever the opposite of a meeting of the minds is. I guess it's called creative differences. I wrote the script and was directing it. You know, I had cast the film and chosen the locations. And you know, he was a director and I was a director. And we had creative differences, and I left the film. And Star Trek, it was strange because the studio, we were all set to really go into production on that. They didn't really quite know what they had, but this was, as you say, before Star Wars came out. And somebody at the studio said a line that I love: there's no future in science fiction. And 2 weeks later, Star Wars came out after they had canceled the project. And it was
right. So much for prophecy.
Yeah, so much for prophecy, and you know, I guess there is some future in science fiction, or there was some future.
Henry and June is really a family project for you. Your wife Rose is the co-writer of the screenplay, and your son Peter is the producer of the movie. Do you like keeping it like that, or does it ever get frustrating because there's maybe no safe haven, you know? And any problem with the movie is going to, like, bleed over into the family.
Yeah. Well, you know, at times it can be very intense. When Rose and I were writing some of the scenes of writers arguing, you know, we certainly had our arguments and, you know, violent arguments while we were writing those things. You know, we had, you know, strong differences of opinion, but we... you know, finally worked everything out, and in retrospect, those seem to be, you know, interesting times that we went through. But I like to work intimately with the crew, particularly with the actors. I like the feeling of quote family, of being around people who, you know, are trying to make the same thing. And you know, it's one of the reasons I can't live in Los Angeles, and I really don't. Like to view the films at any point, really, as being part of, quote, the business of making films. I'm really interested in films just as I say, things that interest me and finding a way of you know, telling stories and having an interesting time doing it.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us about your movies.
Well, thanks, Terry.
My guest has been Philip Kaufman, and his new movie is Henry in June. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and Apple Computer in personal computing, providing the power to be your best. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Conductor and composer Leonard Bernstein died yesterday at the age of 72. Coming up, classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz remembers Leonard Bernstein. It's rare enough for a poet to write in rhymes anymore. It was even more unusual when Vikram Seth wrote a novel in verse. Coming up, a talk with the Indian writer about his novel The Golden Gate and his latest collection of poems, All You Who Sleep Tonight. And TV critic David Bianculli reviews Nixon, the 3-hour profile of the rise and fall of Richard Nixon. It airs this week over PBS as part of the American Experience series. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Laura Kanoy. 8 more Americans and their dependents left Iraq over the weekend, White House officials said today. A U.S. family detained last week was also released. Kuwait's exiled government today ruled out any compromise with Iraq. After a 3-day meeting in Jeddah, Saudi Arabia, Kuwait's ousted rulers and over 1,000 prominent exiles issued a statement urging the United Nations to quickly remove Iraqi troops from their country. The communique promised greater democracy in Kuwait under the Emirates' 1962 constitution that allowed an elected parliament. French President François Mitterrand said today France would continue protecting Lebanon's rebel Christian leader General Michel Aoun. Aoun took refuge in the French embassy in Beirut this weekend. From Paris, Lynn Terry reports.
President Mitterrand said General Aoun could stay in the French embassy until he was able to come to France as he wished. This weekend, France granted Aoun political asylum. However, the Lebanese government wants him tried on criminal charges, and it's warned France against trying to smuggle him out of the country. President Mitterrand said France will not turn Aoun over. That decision could provoke a diplomatic stalemate between the two countries, though Mitterrand tried to reassure the Lebanese government. He said if and when Aoun came to France, he would not be allowed to set up a government in exile here. During the press conference, Mitterrand also announced that France was planning to send additional troops to Saudi Arabia, though he refused to give any details. For National Public Radio, this is Lynn Terry in Paris.
Palestinian leader Sari Nusseibeh was arrested today, charged with associating with hostile elements. Linda Gradstein reports from Jerusalem.
Sari Nusseibeh's arrest came as a surprise today. His family said he was arrested at home at 9 this morning, and they still had not heard from him by this evening. Israel TV said he is charged with meeting hostile elements both inside and outside Israel, apparently a reference to the PLO. Nusseibeh, a professor at Birzeit University, is known as a moderate who participates in dialogue with Israelis. In the past, Nusseibeh has been accused of helping to run the Intifada, the Palestinian uprising in the Israeli-occupied territories, but he was never formally charged. Another Palestinian leader, Faisal Husseini, remains in jail today. Husseini is charged with organizing last week's violence on the Temple Mount, in which Israeli border police shot dead 21 Palestinians. For National Public Radio, this is Linda Gradstein in Jerusalem.
Vietnam's foreign minister will visit Washington this week to discuss new information about nearly 1,700 Americans still missing from the Vietnam War. It's the first trip ever to the U.S. by such a high-ranking Vietnamese official. The U.S. has never had diplomatic relations with Hanoi. Stock prices closed higher today. The Dow Jones Industrial Average rose 18 points to 2416.34. Advances edge declines in active trading of 166 million shares. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. That's Leonard Bernstein conducting the overture to his Broadway musical Candide. The conductor, composer, educator, and theatrical musical personality died in New York Sunday night at the age of 72, just 5 days after announcing his retirement as a conductor. He died of a heart attack caused by progressive lung failure. Classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz is on the line with us from Boston. Hi, Lloyd.
Hi, Terry.
Bernstein had been known to be ill for quite some time. How is the musical world registering his loss?
I think with disbelief. He was a figure of such youthfulness and energy and incredible versatility. I think it was hard to believe he would ever die.
Bernstein was probably most famous as a conductor. When he was 40 years old in 1959, he was appointed musical director of the New York Philharmonic, and that was the first time an American conductor was chosen to lead a major American orchestra. Can you talk with us about his conducting?
Well, he was a brilliant, exciting conductor. And he would do almost anything to get an audience and the musicians themselves excited. No one was more theatrical on the podium than Bernstein. He jumped up and down. He thrust out his arms. He had facial contortions. You know, it was as if he were acting out all the emotions that he heard in the music. Bernstein was also one of the major figures to champion American music, especially composers like Charles Ives and his own mentor, Aaron Copland. I think he was also a popularizer. He made people on many levels love classical music. The Young People's Concerts on TV was probably the first introduction a lot of American children had to classical music. I had a passion for Mahler that I think was one of the main reasons Mahler is so popular today.
Well, let's listen to an excerpt of Bernstein conducting the New York Philharmonic in Mahler's Third Symphony. What were the controversies about Bernstein as a conductor?
Well, there are obvious limitations to his approach. There's more to music than brilliance and excitement. And Bernstein tended to make everything sound excessive and theatrical, and excessive in the same way.
Let's talk a little bit about Bernstein as a composer.
Well, I think his more serious classical compositions tend to be on the pretentious and heavy side, and really rather derivative. I think his greatest contribution was as a Broadway composer. His four best shows, On the Town, Wonderful Town, West Side Story, and Candide, were really his most original work. And they had a kind of wit and tunefulness and passion and ambition that was really what he was most at home with. And I think they reflected the most appealing side of his own personality.
When I sit and listen to a symphony, why can't I just say the music's grand? Why must I leap up on the stage hysterically? They're playing pizzicato and everything goes blotto. I grab the maestro stick and start in leading the
crowd. Carried away, carried away. And when I go to see a moving picture show, and I'm watching actors in a scene, I start to think what's happening is really so. The girl, I must protect her. The villain, don't respect her. I leap to her defense and knock a hole right through the screen.
Carried away,
carried away.
Bernstein was really one of the few classical music composers who also wrote for the Broadway stage. Can you hear the influence of one form of music on the other in his writing?
Yeah, I think one of the great things about the shows was that they combined popular idioms, jazz and show music, with classical forms and rather daring, inventive harmonies and syncopations. Things like the quintet in West Side Story are really a unique mixture of complicated classical techniques and show music.
Well, I want to thank you very much for helping us remember Leonard Bernstein.
Thank you.
Lloyd Schwartz is classical music editor of the Boston Phoenix and classical music critic for Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. Poets these days write in rhyme and meter. Vikram Seth not only writes poems that rhyme, but he wrote his novel, The Golden Gate, in metered verse. The 1986 novel was a love story set in contemporary San Francisco. Seth wrote it while in graduate school in California. Seth was born in Calcutta and spent most of his youth in India. He studied in England before coming to the U.S. His new collection of poems, All You Who Sleep Tonight, is written in rhyme. I asked him why he writes in a style that most contemporary poets have abandoned.
I suppose when I was very young, the idea that poetry didn't rhyme would have come to me as a bit of a shock. You know, my nursery rhymes, well, being nursery rhymes, they were in rhyme. And most of the poetry that we are brought up on in India is fairly conventional poetry. Lots of Wordsworth, lots of Tennyson, that sort of stuff. So I was rather startled when, in fact, I started reading some modern poetry or poetry written in this century, which didn't rhyme. And then I was even more startled when I found out that those who did try to rhyme their poetry were sort of considered passé or reactionary in some sense. So with desperate eagerness, I started lopping off all the rhymes in my poems and started writing in unrhymed and unmetered forms. And it took me a little while before I came around to the recognition that I shouldn't constrain myself. That is, if a poem came out in free verse, well and good. And if, in fact, it struck me that it was best suited to rhyme and meter, then that's what I should do. In other words, I should just let the poem breathe the way that it wanted to.
Let me ask you to read one of the poems that's collected in your new volume. And this poem is called Sure. Soon. You can introduce it for us if you'd like.
All right. Perhaps I'll say a few words after I've read the poem, so as not to kind of precondition anyone. I shall die soon, I know. This thing is in my blood. It will not let me go. It saps my cells for food. It soaks my nights in sweat and breaks my days in pain. No hand or drug can treat these limbs for love or gain. Love was the strange first cause that bred grief in its seed, and gain knew its own laws to fix its place and breed. He whom I love, thank God, who won't speak of hope or cure, it would not do me good. He sees that I am sure. He knows what I have read and will not bring me lies. He sees that I am dead. I read it in his eyes. How am I to go on? How will I bear this taste? My throat cased in white spawn, these hands that shake and waste. Stay by my steel-ward bed and hold me where I lie. Love me when I am dead and do not let me die. Well, there are two things about the poem. The first thing is the obvious one, I suppose, that it's about AIDS, and someone who's dying of it, and this poem is written in the voice of someone who's affected by the disease. The second thing, and this has really nothing to do with the power of the poem, but it might be just of interest, is that every word in that poem is exactly one syllable long. And the reason I didn't want to say either of those two things before I read the poem was that poems need to sort of reveal their own subjects as they're read. And secondly, this sort of stylistic aspect of it, for instance, the fact that every word is one syllable long, that could become obtrusive to the listener if they were conscious of it beforehand.
Well, I'll confess that I've read that poem several times, and I didn't notice that all the words were one syllable long.
I'm very glad of that.
Oh, you're glad of that, huh?
Well, I'm glad of that because I feel that, you know, if one has... I don't think art or form should bludgeon the reader or the listener. If it works, it should work quietly.
Well, what interested you in that form?
I just found the poem coming out like that. And I suppose, though this isn't something that I would lay too much weight on, that the breathlessness that maybe is associated with the subject of the poem, the difficulty of speech and of any kind of expenditure of energy, might perhaps have some relation to it.
What kind of structures have you been working with, or have you worked with, in your rhyming metered poems?
Well, the one that perhaps has influenced me the most, in that I wrote a whole book of, I guess, 300 pages in it, is what's known as the Pushkin stanza. And that's a stanza that was formed and immortalized by Alexander Pushkin, the great Russian poet and novelist. It's a 14-line stanza, rather like a sonnet, except that instead of having 5 feet like the standard Shakespearean sonnet, it has 4. So it goes sort of, ta-dum, 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 I'd like to read this poem out, or I hear your name is Terry Gross, or something like that. So it's got a 4-beat line. And it's got an elaborate rhyming pattern. But again, what pleased me about this meter, especially when I was reading Pushkin's Eugene Onegin, was that he can write about the most flippant things in this meter, and they take off, and then he can write about things that just have you in tears. And it's the same form. It's the same strict form.
Do you find it difficult to read metered rhyming verse and not have it sound really sing-song?
Has this got something to do with what I did just now?
Well, no, but even when you're it's like ta-tum, 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 ta-tum.
That's actually the sort of pedagogic explanation.
Yeah,
of it.
I was just emphasizing it.
But for instance, if I were reading, say, a stanza of, the Golden Gate, I would certainly not read it in that way. For instance, in a passage, John is complaining to Jan. He says, I'm young, employed, healthy, ambitious, sound, solvent, self-made, self-possessed, but all my symptoms are pernicious. The Dow Jones of my heart's depressed. The sunflower of my youth is wilting. The tower of my dreams is tilting. The zoom lens of my zest is blurred. The drama of my life's absurd. What is the root of my neurosis? I jog, eat brewer's yeast each day, and yet I feel life slip away. I wait your sapient diagnosis. I die, I faint, I fail, I sink. You need a lover, John, I think. It doesn't have to be read, you know. It should be read any you know, lively way.
Now, you've studied in England, America, and China. Have you found there to be really different teaching styles in each country?
I would say that one thing that struck me when I went from England, where I'd been an undergraduate, to America, where I was a graduate student, was this. There's a great amount of freedom given in England for people to sort of follow their own inclination, their own bent, their own interests. When I went to America as a graduate student, I found, oddly enough, I felt as if I was reverting to high school. There were lots of tests all the time, which is quite foreign to the English method of education. And there was a sense that you were continually striving for grades. Now, I don't think that was a very good idea, certainly with respect to certain subjects. It might work for certain scientific subjects, but not, I think, for literature, history, or even the subject that was my subject, economics.
Why did you study economics?
I got into university in England through the literature exams that they have. But there were, in those days, about 9 months between admission to university, at least that university, and entrance. So I wandered home, and I thought a little about things, and I realized I'd never really lose my taste for literature. Why was I going to spend 4 years studying it, especially since much of the curriculum would be reading criticism or reading books which I might have preferred to read more at leisure or at some other time in my life. Then I thought to myself, well, supposing I'm not going to study literature, what will I study? And I realized that economics would be an interesting subject, partly because I thought it might help me to understand the way the world worked, partly because my father, you know, works in business and maybe it would help me understand the way his mind worked, and partly because I thought maybe it would help, you know, help mm-hmm. back home in India.
After living so many years in other countries, you've returned to India. What brought you back there?
Partly, I suppose, the fact that that I could afford to go back. And the second thing was, I suppose, I'd always told myself I'd go back. I wanted to be with the family. My folks are not, you know, very young. And I also wanted to write a novel set in India. But the fact was that although I thought that my degree in California would only stretch out for 4 years, I found year following year, and by the end of it was about 11 years. So I decided, okay, I'm getting out now. Book's been published. I can afford to get out. If I don't get out now, I don't know when I will. I was enjoying California so much, I could have stayed there forever.
Let me ask you to read one more poem. Would you read Round and Round for us? It's the first poem in your new collection.
Right. Round and Round. After a long and wretched flight that stretched from daylight into night, where babies wept and tempers shattered, and the plane lurched and whiskey splattered over my plastic food, I came to claim my bags from baggage claim. Around, the carousel went around. The anxious travelers sought and found their bags, intact or gently battered, but to my foolish eyes what mattered was a brave suitcase, red and small, that circled round, not mine at all. I knew that bag, it must be hers. We hadn't met in 7 years, and as the steel plates squealed and clattered, my happy memories chimed and chattered. An old man pulled it off the claim. My bags appeared, I did the same.
Thanks so much for talking with us.
Sure, Terry, thank you.
Vikram Seth's latest volume of poems, All You Who Sleep Tonight, is published by Knopf. This is Fresh Air. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Noah Adams is with us. Hi, Noah.
Hi, Terry. A discussion of the political future of the Arab world. Could, for example, a democracy be established in Kuwait? And would this be in part as a result of the Iraqi invasion of Kuwait? We'll talk with two South African exiles, both left that country in the mid-1970s, and both are thinking about returning, but they'll refuse to go back if they have to fill out a questionnaire, as requested, that would list their crimes against the South African state. Mikhail Gorbachev has won the Nobel Peace Prize, and NPR's Ann Cooper reports on that from Moscow. And we'll talk with Rachel Warby, the conductor of the Wheeling Symphony Orchestra in West Virginia, on her memories of Leonard Bernstein.
Thanks, Noah. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Tonight on public television, The American Experience presents a 3-hour profile of Richard M. Nixon. TV critic David Bianculli has this review.
But as I leave you, I want you to know, just think how much you're going to be missing. You don't have Nixon to kick around anymore.
That was in 1962, after a bitter Richard Nixon had lost the race for governor of California. But Nixon didn't stay down for long. 6 months later, he was back in the public eye, showing a different side of himself by playing piano and joking with Jack Parr on The Tonight Show.
Can Kennedy be defeated in 64?
Well, which one? Just to be very serious, I know, of course, you're referring to President Kennedy, and I under no circumstances would speak disrespectfully even of him or of his office.
Aren't you kind of friends? Weren't you kind of friends at one time?
Oh, certainly. We came to the Congress together.
I know you.
And we were low men on the totem pole in the Labor Committee together. And we remained low men until he ran for president. Now he's up and I'm down.
The rest, as they say, is history. And on public television, history is on a roll these days. thanks to the phenomenal success of the Civil War. Now, I'm not saying that this three-hour biography of Nixon is nearly as good. It's not. But, like the Civil War, it's an impressive and watchable overview, and it's got some little touches that work really well. That isn't too surprising, because the writer on this Nixon program is Jeffrey C. Ward, who just so happens to have been the principal writer on the Civil War series. So it makes sense that this Nixon special makes great use of period photographs, including shots from Nixon's school yearbooks. One book shows Nixon's face next to that of the preppy-looking guy who beat him for class president. Another yearbook, after Nixon had been elected school president, contains what is probably the very first cartoon caricature of Richard M. Nixon. But the meat of the show, of course, is Watergate. And for this American Experience documentary, new interviews are conducted with such Watergate alumni as John Dean, Charles Colson, and John Ehrlichman. The only one who displays a lot of emotion, though, is Ehrlichman, Nixon's former second lieutenant, who still hasn't forgotten what it was like to be canned by the president.
At some point, he asked me if there was anything that he could do for me. I said, yeah, I'd like you to explain this all to my kids, because I'm having trouble explaining to them why you would do this. And he didn't respond to that. So we ended up in a hug. We hugged each other, and I could see that he had said everything that he could, and that was the end of it.
If you weren't alive or aware during the 50s, 60s, and 70s, this program called Nixon is a must. But to those who lived through it, so many dramatic moments are missing from this show, or so quickly condensed, that it's sometimes frustrating to watch. 1 hour per decade simply isn't enough time to dissect Richard Nixon properly. And, as his personal history indicates, Nixon's story isn't over till it's over. Even now, he's building a new image as an elder statesman. Richard Nixon was dead wrong in 1962. We'll be kicking the idea and legacy of Nixon around for a long, long time.
David Bianculli is TV critic for the New York Post. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our engineers this week are Audra Vlahakis, Thad Kirk, Dan Lachlan, and Joyce Lieberman. Roberta Shurrock directed the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, by this and other NPR member stations, and by a grant from Talbots, retailers of women's classic clothing and accessories through stores and catalogs, 1-800-8-TALBOTS. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk to a cop who kept the other cops in line. Vincent Morano worked undercover in the New York City Police Internal Affairs Division, posing as mobsters and hitmen to catch corrupt policemen. And we meet Paul Westerberg, lead singer and songwriter for the band The Replacements. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.